And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Roderick's with you again for our second hour. Thanks for joining us. When Mitt Romney won the Republican presidential nomination in 2012, he put an end to doubts that Americans would ever accept a Mormon candidate. True, Romney lost, but experts agree that changing demographics and Barack Obama's superior organization made the difference, not Romney's religion. Our next guest, our guest this hour, says the nation was far less tolerant when the first Mormon ran for president way back in 1844. Actually, Joseph Smith wasn't just the first Mormon candidate, but the first Mormon, period. Our guest, Alex Beam, describes him as one of America's first religious superstars. The charismatic and flamboyant leader created from scratch an entire religion, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, with himself as the reigning prophet. The faith was based on Joseph Smith's own revised version of the Bible, transcribed, he said, after an angel directed him to a set of golden plates buried in a New York hillside. In an era of religious revivals, the new church caught on despite ridicule, persecution, and violence from traditional Christians who called Smith a heretic and were scandalized by his personal embrace of polygamy. The new church attracted thousands to Joseph Smith's vision of Zion, a new settlement on the Mississippi called Nauvoo, which briefly was the second largest city in Illinois. According to Alex Beam, Joseph Smith ran the city by fiat, declaring, quote, "I am above the kingdoms of the world. I have no laws." But tensions between the Mormons and their neighbors reached the breaking point in 1844, when Smith and his brother surrendered to local authorities and were shot to death by members of a mob who stormed the jail. No one was ever convicted of the crime, and Smith's followers, under the leadership of Brigham Young, headed west again to escape persecution. Eventually, they reached Utah, far from the reach of their enemies and the U.S. government. Regardless of what one thinks of Smith's visions and his claim to be God's chosen prophet, Joseph Smith was charismatic and flamboyant as a leader who inspired legions of followers and a church that now claims 15 million members worldwide. Alex Beam has spent more than three decades as a journalist and author. His twice-weekly column has appeared in the Boston Globe since 1987. Before that, he reported for Newsweek and then for Business Week, serving as the magazine's bureau chief in Boston and Moscow. He's the author of two previous nonfiction books, both notable books from the New York Times. One, Gracefully Insane, Life and Death Inside America's Premier Mental Hospital, and A Great Idea at the Time, The Rise and Fall and Curious Afterlife of the Great Books. His latest is American Crucifixion, The Murder of Joseph Smith and the Fate of the Mormon Church. It's available from the Public Affairs Press. Alex Beam, I welcome you to Baltimore and the Midday Show. Thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
What got you to this? This is fascinating stuff, and it's a terrifically written book. It's very, very well written. It's fascinating. First-rate job of historical journalism, particularly for non-Mormons whose knowledge of the church and its history has been rudimentary at best. So I'll say that to you. But I just wonder what got you to it.
Well, thanks for the kind words, Dan. It's a mundane story. I wish it were a more glamorous story, but a very young editor at Public Affairs thought that this was an unwritten book, frankly. He thought that this was an amazing episode in American history that was violent. It took place on the American frontier. It was about one of America's great religions, and it had a lot of sex in it. I mean, crass as it is to point out, the fact that Joseph Smith was pushing this doctrine of polygamy on his followers really led to his own downfall and ultimately to his killing. But the idea came from outside of me. I mean, I had a sort of fascination with the Mormons, but I have to admit that the project found me.
Okay. You know, this is a period of American history. I was thinking about this time in the 19th century, after the War of 1812, before the Civil War, that whole long period of history there. We kind of skip over it in history classes. It doesn't seem to generate a lot of interest, yet there was a lot going on. And since we're talking about Joseph Smith and the Mormon Church, I wonder if you could sort of give us what the maybe religious temperature was of the country at the time? You know that there was a kind of a religious revival going on, but, a revival from what?
Well, yeah, the religious temperature was like hot, hot, hot. The period into which Joseph Smith walks is called the Second Great Awakening in America. The First Great Awakening took place in the 18th century, in the previous century. The revival here is really the young American Republic rebelling against the establishment and the non-establishment churches of the old world, of Great Britain specifically. Which would mean the Anglican Church and even Methodism, which was in itself kind of a revolt against the Church of England. A lot of Joseph's converts came from the Methodist religion, came from Presbyterians, it's sort of second wave Protestantism, if you will, reinvented in the New World. These are essentially the second to third generation of European Americans, and where he grew up was in what was called the burned over district of upstate New York, where he was far from the only, charismatic preacher with a very dramatic story intended to woo followers.
Well, tell us a bit about how he grew up, where he grew up. You mentioned upstate New York. I know he grew up on a farm, right? But, as many people did. But what was his early life like, and were there any signs that he'd be a great religious leader someday?
Well, that's sort of a controversial story. The early years of Joseph Smith are a real historical battlefield. He was in a large family that at one time numbered as many as eight, very typical American story. Although born in Vermont, he grew up in Palmyra, New York, not too far from the Erie Canal, which was under construction and eventually brought a fair amount of prosperity to that. That's a cold and sort of forbidding part of the world up there, just south of the Great Lakes. Joseph's first, aside from working on the farm, his first profession was that of diviner, scryer, or treasure hunter, which is kind of three ways of saying the same thing. But he was a young man who, for money, would come onto your property and look for water. Or a scryer is someone who uses a tool, sometimes a secret stone, to look for treasure. Joseph searched for buried treasure. In fact, that's how he met his wife on a commission in Pennsylvania. A guy thought he had Spanish treasure on his farm. So he had a kind of early mystical bent, which was not all that uncommon in that part of the world. And, this Mormons don't like to hear this, but the serious scholarship draws a line, in a sense, between his quest for treasure and then his, finding these sacred plates, the Book of Mormon, underground. The angel Moroni came to the young Joseph Smith and told him that these sacred plates were buried at the Hill Cumorah, not too far from where he was living. But you can easily see there's sort of a metaphorical analogy between digging for buried treasure and then finding a sacred buried treasure that later turns out to be the touchstone of this brilliant new religion.
So an early mystical bent, divining rods, magic stones to help find maybe water, maybe a treasure buried on farmland. But you say there was a lot of that going on. Well, people were superstitious, right?
Well, sure. Not only were people superstitious, there was no particular science. Finding water on your property was probably, the path determined whether you were going to be prosperous or not.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about the Spanish treasure that, I kind of so casually throw out there is that there was a perception. America was very, very young. And, of course, these were unsettled territories in America. And so the perception was that some civilization had been there before, whether it was a rich Native American civilization. Of course, they saw Native Americans, or a rich kind of mythical civilization like an Inca or Spanish civilization. It was totally reasonable for these people to think that there would be traces of the wealth that had come before them. So that's the context into which Joseph fit in when he was wearing that particular hat.
Okay. Did his family belong to a particular church?
That's a good question. His family were kind of seekers. There were four churches in Palmyra. I'd be hard pressed sitting here to name them all, but they were the, you know, Baptist, Presbyterian, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the whole touchstone of the Mormon religion is his father's not particularly religious. His mom is attending more than one church, and Joseph says, if there's only one God, because they were Christians, they were Christian monotheists. Joseph poses the question, if there's only one God, why are there four churches? And he received an answer. He says, you know, from an angel or from the Godhead itself, he had dreams about communing with God. And God said to him, the churches that exist on earth now are corrupt. And so the subtext was that he was going to show Joseph Smith a path and eventually a book, the Book of Mormon, that described the one true church, the true restoration of Christian monotheism in North America.
Well, we're going to get next to Joseph Smith's epiphany after this short break, and we continue our conversation with Alex Beam, who's joining us to talk about his new book, American Crucifixion, The Murder of Joseph Smith and the Fate of the Mormon Church. You're listening to Midday. A short break. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Dan Rodericks with Alex Beam, columnist in Boston at the Boston Globe, author of American Crucifixion, The Murder of Joseph Smith and the Fate of the Mormon Church. It's a fascinating story about the founder of Mormonism, a controversial and charismatic character to this day, but one little known outside of religious circles. Alex Beam says Joseph Smith was one of America's first evangelical superstars, but fell victim to a combination of religious bigotry and his own flamboyance. Let's go to how it all started then. And it's a story I know that has been told. There are entire volumes written about this. But you summarize briefly could you summarize briefly for us the epiphanies and revelations that led Joseph Smith to found the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints?
Yeah, sure, Dan. I mean, the church, as I said before the break, Joseph was a seeker and a questioner, and already in his late teen years, he had what is now called the first vision, when God the Father and Jesus Christ came to him in the evening and said, at nighttime in a dream essentially, and said, you know, you're on the right track. We're going to show you the path to the one true church. At which point Joseph has meetings with the angel Moroni, who tells him about the existence of the sacred plates that constitute the Book of Mormon. Now there's several sort of hiccups and slips, as many a slip as they say, twixt the cup and the lip. But eventually, Joseph finds his way to the Hill Cumorah. This is, of course, Joseph's account of what happened. He digs in the place the angel has told him to dig, and he unearths these golden tablets. And this is really the beginning. 1830 is the first year that he constitutes an actual church. The church is constituted after he has translated by revelation. Again, there's more than one account of how he created the Book of Mormon. But the Book of Mormon is the foundational stone that allows him to create the Mormon church in 1830. And I'll be happy to, you know, explain a tiny bit, if you like, about, I mean, what makes the book, you know, what makes the Book of Mormon a new Bible, at least in the view of
Please
Joseph.
Do. Yeah, please do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's the Book of Mormon is a holy canonical Bible for Mormons. There are three Bibles, the Old Testament, the New Testament, and the Book of Mormon. And the Book of Mormon is is the Word of God talking about a civilization that lived in North America essentially three millennia ago, a civilization with two warring tribes. These are tribes that supposedly came to North America from Israel, the Lamanites and the Nephites. And in any case, Moroni is a survivor, the last Nephite. And if I make mistakes, I apologize. I'm not a Mormon. But in any case, the Book of Mormon is the story of this sort of great Native American, in the sense of a civilization that came from the Middle East, that took root in North America. It includes Jesus Christ visiting North America, at least maybe visiting Central America. I mean, Mormon archaeologists spend a lot of time trying to figure this out. In any case, the stirring importance of the Book of Mormon is that it brings the tale of Jesus Christ and the Christian revelation. It takes it out of the Middle East, takes it out of Galilee, out of Judea, out of Jerusalem, and brings it right here. So if you can imagine, you know, a man or woman living in upstate New York in 1830, this is Joseph's way of recruiting adherents. He says, I've discovered a new Bible, and the great revelation is that there's a new restoration of the mastery of Jesus Christ, of the rule of Jesus Christ, and it's taking place right here where we live.
And that's what made it appealing, because you know, there were so many people so willing to believe in this new religion. He basically invented his own version of Christianity from the ground up, with a new story, a new chapter, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one thing that's fascinating is that it doesn't really grow all that quickly. The first like 14 members of the Mormon Church are really just relatives of Joseph's, and it snowballs a tiny bit on the strength of this book. They print 1,500 copies of the Book of Mormon, which is key, and they hail it as a new Bible. And interestingly, of course, it sounds like the old Bible. If anyone's ever been in a Marriott motel or a Marriott hotel, you know, you can reach right under the telephone, you'll find the Book of Mormon there, where you might find a Bible in some other place of lodging. And the Book of Mormon reads exactly like the King James Version of the Bible. Which of course is the version that Joseph Smith and everyone in upstate New York would have been reading. So it sounds a lot like a Bible. And indeed, what happens in the Book of Mormon is told in the language of the King, you know, told in this kind of ancient non-horrific language. On the strength of the Book of Mormon and on the strength of zealous missionary activity that, of course, continues to our very day, the church does start to grow.
Okay. The golden plates. I've always been fascinated by this part of the story, that Joseph Smith never produced the golden plates. He never, you know, put them on display for people to see.
No, absolutely not. I mean, this is, of course, this is the exposed sharp edge of Mormon belief. I was literally just doing some more reading this morning. There's so much. Joseph told more than one story, for instance, about how he translated the golden plates, which he translated through a canvas cloth. So even he purported never to have seen the golden plates. But, I mean, briefly, he told one story about how a pair of spectacles was included with the golden plates. He called them the Urim and the Thummim. But a lot of Americans have heard the other version, which is how, you know, he stared into a hat and saw the words of the Book of Mormon revealed to him in a seer stone. And the plates purportedly were written in a language called Reformed Egyptian. There's a whole story behind this. I'm just going to add two more things that are relevant to your question. I mean, first of all, Joseph told people after the successful translation of the Book of Mormon that the angel Moroni had taken the plates away. So that in part explains why no one ever saw the plates. Integral to the Mormon religion, and I'm pretty accurate on this. I'm sure someone could find holes in what I'm saying. But again, if you're in that Marriott and you look in the back of the Book of Mormon, you'll see statements first by the three witnesses and then, I believe, by the eight witnesses. In other words, Joseph understood that this was sounded like a really tall tale. So at first he recruited three men to be, quote unquote, witnesses to the translation of Book of Mormon, although their witness, it turns out, again, is sort of metaphorical or allegorical. When pressed, they do not claim to have seen the plates. And then some of those people leave the church, so he recruits eight more witnesses who, again, do not necessarily, they claim to have had an angelic vision of the plates, you know, perhaps a hypnotic or a dream vision. But so indeed, it's a story that has not ever really been materially proven.
We're speaking with Alex Beam on Midday. Alex Beam is the author of American Crucifixion, The Murder of Joseph Smith and the Fate of the Mormon Church. This makes me want to go back to an earlier part of our conversation when we were talking about Joseph Smith's early life around Palmyra up in New York, when he wondered why there were, if there was one God, why are there four churches? Here he was creating his own church, and here he was presenting himself as a very special person, maybe not a God, but certainly a person with a connection to God indirectly through the angel Moroni. Joseph Smith, did he believe that men could become gods?
Well, later, in the late 1830s, Joseph started working on this extremely controversial cosmology, which is, in a sense, what you and I have been talking about happens in the early 1830s.
Mm-hmm.
In the last 2 to 3 years, he preaches the unbelievably famous King Follett sermon in 1843. I hope I have that date right, which Harold Bloom says is the most important sermon ever preached on North American soil, and he includes Jonathan Edwards' sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, in that list. In other words, Harold Bloom says this is the most important sermon ever, and that's where Joseph Smith says, indeed, as you point out, that the person whom, let's take me as an example, because I actually attend an Episcopal church. Joseph Smith says, the person whom I pray to as God was once a human being, and he unveils in this sermon the so-called doctrine of eternal progression, meaning that indeed all gods were once human, and all humans are destined to become gods.
You know, this is a form of Christianity, right?
I apologize for mixing you up. I happen to think so.
It is.
Yeah. But a lot of people disagree.
Right. If you were to go, I have no experience in the Mormon church, Alex, so I'm curious about this, in the modern Mormon church, the 21st century Mormon church, if one were to attend a service in a Mormon temple, would one who is brought up in a Catholic faith or any of the Christian churches feel at home, understand what was happening, hear scripture that was familiar?
Okay, that's a very complicated question, Dan, and I'm going to try to be as clear as I possibly can. You and I will not be witnessing anything inside a Mormon temple because it's completely closed to Gentiles or non-Mormons. A church, so in other words, there's a distinction between a church and a temple.
Mm-hmm.
I have attended a Mormon church service, and it's extremely bare. It's a little bit like attending a Unitarian service. There's, of course, a reading. Readings from the Book of Mormon. There's what I would call communion. It's conceivable they have a different name for it, but it's the same ritual, the Eucharist ritual, where you have bread and water, not bread and wine. There are other components to the church ritual. There's testimony, which is very important, where members of the ward, as it's called, the parish, testify to their belief or testify. Again, that's an integral part of some Christian religions,
mm-hmm.
not mine. But testify to the intervention of God, or the intervention of the Book of Mormon in their lives. So it's actually I apologize to the Mormon listeners. I don't recall seeing a crucifix. In fact, I unapologize, because the crucifix is not an emblem at the Mormon religion. The reason I unapologize is because I just remembered a story about a woman who was chastised at Brigham Young University, a librarian, for wearing a crucifix. So that's considered a kind of almost idolatrous element of the corrupt Christian church.
Hmm.
So in other words, it's a very spare church environment. Children are in the environment, and I would compare it to maybe a Quaker or Congregationalist type meeting.
Okay, so let's go back 150 years or more, actually. There's a backlash to this. Joseph Smith's invented a church. He's the Book of Mormon has been published in 1830. He's getting, the more adherence. It's growing. But what was it about this new theology, the Mormon theology, that so offended the traditional Christians who were around at that time?
Right. Well, it's an out and out blasphemy, of course, to say that you're a prophet of God, that you're the one who's been in touch with God, and it's an out and out blasphemy to create a new gospel. I mean, in a sense, I think if we put ourselves in the shoes of the people who despised the Mormons in the 1830s and the 1840s, these are just conventional people in a way, a little bit like me, you know, who go to a conventional church,
right?
And suddenly somebody says, "Oh, I got a new Bible." I mean, first of all, you think he's a nut,
mm-hmm.
and then when their church is bigger than yours, you know, you start thinking he's a dangerous nut. And so he runs into trouble very early in the game. I mean, his first serious congregation is in Kirtland, Ohio. He builds a temple in Kirtland, Ohio, and they're chased out of there. Now, Joseph did have this predilection for kind of harebrained ideas, a lot of them. And in Kirtland, Ohio, he started a bank. It was an illegal bank. A lot of people lost money, so he was chased out of town. I mean, the astonishing next chapter in Joseph's life takes place in Missouri, where he takes an ever-growing colony of Mormons, now numbering in the thousands. He takes them to what he actually has always regarded as the true Zion in North America, because he believes that the Garden of Eden was in Independence, Missouri. So he takes his flock out there to a few counties in Missouri where pretty darned quickly they sort of become public enemy number one.
And this is, I hope I pronounced it correctly, Nauvoo?
No, Nauvoo is in Illinois.
That's in Illinois. That's the next step.
Right. In okay. Missouri, you get what's called the Mormon War. I mean, they infuriate their neighbors so much that there's an extermination order,
right?
You know, that chases them across the Mississippi River to Illinois, where they eventually found what is going to be, in fact, in your intro, you referred to, this will be possibly the most successful city in Illinois, called, Nauvoo, Illinois,
Nauvoo.
Right on the Mississippi. Yeah.
Hey, one thing about this period in time, Joseph Smith, he often dresses in full military regalia. In fact, some of the drawings I see of him show him that way, and on horseback, he looks like George Washington or something. What's that all about?
He proclaimed himself. It's funny you mentioned Washington, because he proclaimed himself to be a lieutenant general, and I it turned out he was only the second lieutenant general in American history, although the other one I believe was George Washington. And then the third one was Ulysses Grant. Anyway, well, this was part of his, some people can disagree with me, but I mean, Joseph had these sort of monomaniacal delusions, if you will, and by the time the Mormons got to Illinois, they definitely viewed themselves as a persecuted people, and they had reason to view themselves as such. And having been involved in a war in as recently as 1838 in Missouri, they started an army when they got to Illinois. It's called the Nauvoo Legion. It had between 2,000 and 3,000 men, and Joseph. It was sort of a play army. You know, the officers have Napoleonic regalia. Again, if you look in my book, or if you want to look on the internet, yes, Joseph dolled himself up, you know, with a cockaded hat and military braid. He actually imported that uniform from London. Maybe it was from Philadelphia via London. I have no idea. I think he imported, you know, some absolutely garish uniform, cost $800 at the time.
Wow.
For himself. Yeah, it was a lot of money. I mean, this was just nutty stuff. He had a cavalry saber he brandished. You know, he famously brandished it just a few days before his death. But, I mean, this was also, it was not a good idea for the Mormons to start their own army in Illinois, because it terrified everyone in the state. You know, of course, we know from the Constitution and elsewhere that you're allowed to keep a militia, but the militia of Illinois answered to the governor of Illinois, and they were, you know, they formed only when the governor of Illinois said it was appropriate. The militia of Illinois, for instance, fought in the Black Hawk War. Abraham Lincoln was a militia member. But this was a standing Mormon army in southwestern Illinois that absolutely terrified their neighbors.
And it looked like he's, when you present that way, in this militaristic way, including with a saber or a sword, it looks like you're fixing for a fight. And there had already been threats. You mentioned, of course, there's a massacre along the way, right?
Well, yeah, there was a massacre in the Hans Mill massacre in 1838, claimed, I think, between just over 30 Mormon lives. Children were killed. I mean, this is to illustrate this point that, their view of themselves as a persecuted religion is not paranoiacal. There was a lot of shooting going on in Missouri. There's a lot of shooting going on in Illinois. The Mormons, partly because of their religion, also, partly because of their economic success, partly because of their insularity, they were such a huge group, a city of 12,000. The county seat in Hancock County, where the Mormons had chosen to settle, was Carthage. There were fewer than 1,000 residents there. So basically all these Illinois farmers felt, they were being outnumbered. The Mormons were controlling all the politics in that county and in several Illinois counties. So they were heading for what was going to be really an armed confrontation between the Mormons and their neighbors.
We'll stop here for a moment and pick up the story there then. Alex Beam with us in this hour. We're talking about his new book, American Crucifixion, The Murder of Joseph Smith and the Fate of the Mormon Church. This is Midday on WYPR. Short break. We'll come back and continue the story. Yes, we're speaking with Alex Beam in this hour of the show, author of a new book about one of the most fascinating and charismatic figures of the early 19th century, Joseph Smith, founder of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, more commonly known as the Mormon Church. The book is called American Crucifixion. The name of the church, did you look into that, Alex, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, to understand the name of the church that Joseph Smith came up with?
Yes, when Joseph was sort of laying down the first tenets of the Mormon Church, he described it as a restoration of the Old Testament gospel, a renewal, but also, as so many revolutions, he hearkened back to sort of a purer religious time, the time of the Old and New Testaments. Although we'll get to the Old Testament in a second. But if you look in the New Testament, Joseph correctly noted that both Jesus and his apostles call their followers saints. It's in the King James Version. It will gather the saints. It just means men and women who are followers of Christ. That also crops up in a lot of hymns, for all the saints who from their labors rest. So he was just adopting... It's funny because I call them the Mormon saints and they call themselves the saints, but it was something that he just noticed. He noticed in the New Testament in that instance. I mean, okay. I'm mentioning the restoration of the gospel because, of course, his doctrine of polygamy came straight from the Old Testament.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because I was about to ask you what you learned in your research here once and for all about Joseph Smith and polygamy and then later Brigham Young. And Joseph Smith and his followers, the other leaders, other men who became leaders in the early Mormon church, what did you learn about polygamy?
Well, I learned a lot, first of all. And secondly, it is uncanny. I was going to say unbelievable. I guess it's a tired adjective. But, I mean, the Mormon church has really, they don't like to talk about Joseph and polygamy, and and it's made problems for them. But in any case, so it's only relatively recently that the serious scholarship has come to light. In any case, Joseph had one of his many revelations. He had 120 of them, direct revelations where God is speaking through him. And one of them was, sort of a reprisal of what you do find in the Old Testament, this notion that a man could have more than one wife. Abraham, I believe, had more than one wife. King Solomon had 700 wives. Joseph saw, it's written in the Old Testament, clear as day. And in the time that I choose to write about, meaning the end of his life, around 1843, Joseph starts telling his closest confidants, it's written in the Old Testament, I've had a revelation, I need you to take a second, third, maybe even a fourth wife. And it is an absolutely scandalous doctrine. It is scandalous inside the Mormon Church. It's scandalous outside the Mormon Church. Word of plural marriage, if you want to call it that, celestial marriage, it has a lot of names. The word of polygamy leaks really quickly. And in fact, Joseph is soon famous, or rather notorious, all over America for having many wives. And in fact, you know, Mormonism is just plain ridiculed. I mean, it's ridiculed as kind of a sex-crazed, newfangled, blasphemous religious denomination. In Nauvoo, I believe, by the time Joseph is killed in 1844, I think there are 143 polygamous relationships involving probably as few as, I don't know, 30 men. It's extremely complicated. Most Mormon leaders, and this was a secret doctrine, it's important to remember, so it's not like they were urging a lot of people. It was kind of the top people at the beginning were taking multiple wives, and most of them were comfortable taking only between three and four or five multiple wives. Joseph had as few as 33 or as many as 51, you know, depending on which historian you read.
Well, given that, did he make any public statements about polygamy? Did he talk about it at all in public?
In public, never. Never in his lifetime. You mentioned Brigham Young, who would become sort of America's most famous polygamist after the Mormons moved to Utah. The Mormons only spoke publicly, they spoke publicly about polygamy for the first time in 1852, which is 8 years after Joseph's killing. I think they had a sense for how you know, it's after, among other things, it's illegal. It's also, you know, the Christianity of the New Testament does not recognize a polygamy or bigamy in any form. So it's a secret doctrine until they actually get to Utah. They're outside the United States, and they can pretty much proclaim their desire to do what they want.
Okay. So back to Nauvoo and those in this time period that you're writing about, the tensions are rising between the Mormons and their non-Mormon neighbors, or the Gentiles. The word about polygamy is spreading. Rumors about polygamy are spreading. This was a sore point. What else was going on between the Mormons and the non-Mormons? And I also understand that from your book that there was a split among the Mormons at that time too.
Right. I mean, an additional source of acrimony between the Mormons and the so-called old settlers who made much of having been in Hancock County, Illinois, before the Mormons got there, was also politics. You know, Joseph was almost, again, incredibly, had declared himself to be a candidate for president of the United States in 1844. He was extremely conscious of wielding political power, and he dictated how the 3,000 to 5,000 Mormon votes in his part of Illinois went. So this absolutely infuriated everyone in the area, because the Mormons could elect whomever they wanted to any office in that part of Illinois. And that was ultimately a huge, bone of contention. Worse, what you refer to, the split inside the Mormon Church, happened absolutely exclusively only because of polygamy. There, a small group of Mormon dissidents surfaced in late 1843, led by a prominent and wealthy Canadian follower of Joseph Smith named William Law, who broke with Joseph Smith. Joseph Smith famously made a pass at William Law's beautiful wife. William Law said, enough. You know, this isn't Christian. We were not put on earth to have more than one wife. My bond with my wife is a sacred sealing, a sacred bond. And he declared Joseph to be a heretic very publicly. He started a separate church. And then in the one event that in a complicated way led directly to Joseph's killing, Law and his small group of followers published a dissident newspaper in Nauvoo calling Joseph to task for polygamy and other blasphemous doctrines.
Okay, and that set off something that gets us to the June 1844, What were the events that led up to the death of Joseph Smith?
Right. What happens is that the dissidents publish this one newspaper called the Nauvoo Expositor, which accuses Joseph quite accurately of many different transgressions, including taking multiple wives. And Joseph, the day the newspaper appears, has the presses destroyed. He orders a mob to destroy the presses, and his enemies, who are always alert to finding a way to destroy him, his enemies at the county seat indict him and declare him to be a criminal. They sort of basically gin up some law, saying that, you know, that it's illegal to destroy a newspaper. I'm not quite sure if it is illegal to destroy a newspaper, because that was done quite a bit. Abolitionist newspapers were being destroyed all the time.
Right.
In any case, they finally find this reason to indict him. They indict him on that count. They indict him also on a count of having more than one wife. Again, whether that's there is a law, in fact, against that. But they indict him on some other complicated stuff. Joseph responds by fleeing, which is actually the opening scene of my book. It's extremely dramatic. He chooses to flee. He fears that if he goes to the county seat of Carthage to face these charges before a magistrate or whatever kind of kangaroo court they gin up, he fears that he will actually be put to death. So he chooses actually to flee westwards across the Mississippi with his brother and two close confederates.
Right in the middle of that story, we lost our guest, Alex Beam. Or is he back?
Am I back now?
Yeah, you are. I'm sorry about these glitches, Alex.
We're just apologizing to each other, so we'll both stop apologizing.
Okay. It's a good story. You know, this is sort of the climax here of everything. So
yeah, tell me, repeat.
My question was, Joseph Smith flees. He knows he's wanted, and he knows that the militias are forming around Hancock, right?
Yeah.
So why does he come back? Why does he come back?
Because he's the most complicated person in the American 19th century.
Right.
Really is why, I mean, something we haven't talked about, of course, is Joseph has some kind of very complicated bedrock faith and belief in America and in the Constitution. He even felt the Constitution was dictated by God, like the Book of Mormon. And he made personal interventions with American presidents to get on the side of the Mormons. So a part of him believed in American justice. A part of him believed that maybe he could go to Carthage. I mean, and I don't want to portray him as someone who's exactly naive, as is in my book, as I think you may know. Joseph always made sure he had the best legal representation possible. He knew all the excellent lawyers in Illinois, and he was probably, you know, the very last letter of his life, written like 45 minutes before his death, is he's summoning Illinois' greatest lawyer to Carthage to come get him out of jail. But I mean, he sort of thought he could beat the rap. He thought that he'd go to Carthage, some fantastic lawyer would come and spring him, as had happened in the past, or maybe he could appeal to people's decency. He had a lot of faith in his own ability to sort of get out of jams.
But a mob overwhelmed the jail and shot him and his brother.
They were shot in cold blood. I mean, despite the fact that the governor of Illinois had granted them safe passage.
Take the final minutes of the show and answer this question for me. Your book is called American Crucifixion, although Joseph Smith died of gunshot wounds at the hands of a mob, and you're not a Mormon. The title implies parallels with the death of Jesus. But so my question is, to what extent does the martyrdom of Joseph Smith contribute over time, over the next century and a half, to the growth of the Mormon Church?
Right. I want to make crystal clear that Mormons do not regard Joseph as a deity. They regard him as a prophet, a man who spoke to God, which is a key difference.
Mm-hmm.
What they call the martyrdom, that's the phrase that you've correctly brought into the conversation. It's now called the martyrdom. I mean, I guess I would argue that it's sort of the key that slips the lock to all of Mormon history, because when they perceive, once Joseph is killed, the Mormons perceive the United States is simply too dangerous a place for them to be. So Brigham Young leads the entire Mormon religion across the Mississippi River through the incredibly treacherous trek to the barren, desolate Great Salt Lake of Utah. And I mean, the rest we sort of know. I mean, the rest is literally American history.
Right. Well, Alex Beam, I've enjoyed this. Sorry about the glitches during our conversation again, but it really is a very good book. And as I said, especially for non-Mormons whose knowledge of the church and its history is kind of rudimentary and had been informed a bit by a certain musical that's gone from Broadway. It's been here in Baltimore. This will get you up to speed, folks, if you really want to know more about the founding of the Mormon Church. The book, again, is called American Crucifixion. The publisher is Public Affairs, and we've been speaking with its author, Alex Beam, who is a columnist with the Boston Globe, has been for a long time. And so thank you very much, Alex.
Dan, thanks for your interest. Yeah, it's the second drug after Book of Mormon.
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much. Thank you.
All right.
And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Dan Rodericks here for our staff here at Midday. I appreciate you tuning in and sticking with us through those little glitches that we had in this hour of the show. We'll come back tomorrow and do it again in 22 hours. We'll be back for another edition of Midday. So have a great afternoon. We'll see you again soon.
Midday's senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer and director is Jonathan Ahrens. The associate producer, Michael Himowitz. Our interns are James Daly, Tom Cartaxo, and Michelle Richardson. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming available at WYPR.org. Dan Rodericks's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.